Hey, everybody, welcome to Shop Talk Show, episode number 245. We're going to talk a little bit about, spacing things out on websites. We're going to pit against each other margin top versus margin bottom. Who's going to come out on top? Get it? This episode is brought to you in part by Adobe Typekit Marketplace, which is kind of a new thing Typekit is doing. It's a literal marketplace you can go to and buy fonts for a one-off cost that you have then forever. And thus their library is much bigger than it used to be before. It's pretty darn cool. There's a little bit more to know about it though, so stay tuned and listen to that. And a conference coming up in Boston. It's on March 9th. And it's bookended on the 8th and 10th by workshops, but it's called A Day of REST Boston. And it's all about the WordPress REST API, a whole conference about it because there's a lot to know. And it's really, really awesome. Stay tuned to learn more about that. We're going to talk about normalize and sanitize and resets and all that stuff. We're going to talk about jQuery and where it is in the world of JavaScript frameworks these days. We're going to talk about a weird situation in which that not using jQuery is slower somehow, I guess. We're going to talk a little bit about event modules, things like PubSub and when that's appropriate. And several more questions we're going to get to. Mr. Day, please kick things.
Hey there, Shopomaniacs, you're listening to a Jingle Bell Shop Talk Show. Jingle Bell, I'm Dave Rupert, with me is Chris.
It's Hoyer. December 1st as we record this, and it will come out, next week, so it'll be early December still, and I think once it hits December, it's okay to listen to Christmas music.
Holiday jingle, jangle, jongle. What's the past tense of jingle, jangle? Is it jongle? Jingle, jingle, jongled?
Jingled, I guess, but yeah, jongle is better. And if you have a little JavaScript library that makes it snow on your website, by all means, put it on there.
Let it fly. Let it snow. Let it snow. Let it snow.
Oh, I bet there's a let it snow JS. Let me Google it.
How much money and royalties am I racking up here?
there absolutely is. There's competing let it snow JS libraries. Oh, wow. That's great. That's there you awesome.
Go. The first one to do SVG wins,
So. I don't know if I'd trust SVG for that. As much as just hardcore SVG lover as that I am, that full screen particle effect animated SVG is probably the worst thing you could do with SVG.
Oh, really?
I think so. I think you'd be better off with divs practically, because then you could use, will change and translate X and Y to move the things, which you could do with SVG, but there's no guarantee it's going to get GPU'd.
You're just popping DOM. DOMs off.
What is the most performant possible way to do snowflakes? Canvas? I don't even know. Canvas probably
request
WebGL.
The animation frame?
Yeah.
Canvas with RAF or CSS3 transition translate?
I wonder if you put a canvas over the whole thing, pointer events none on it, and request animation frame, that'd probably be okay. But then resolution, I don't know.
Okay, well, Shop Talk listeners, it's your chance to build the most 60 FPS snowflake machine possible. All right, we're looking forward to
it. I would do a search on CodePen first, because I bet there's 1,000 of them there. We got a bunch of questions for you, team. Matthew Hayes writes in about spacing on websites. I've been doing websites for a couple years now, Matthew says. But I always find what's tricky for me is the space handling, specifically margin and padding. Whether it's a vertical or horizontal spacing, it always ends up being a mess. I've been using Inuit CSS lately, which helps with the spacing, but I lack the knowledge of any best practices here. Do you have any recommendations on a successfully organized CSS for spacing? So it's kind of it's tempting to call this a CSS 101 question, but it's probably not really, because I think probably even, you know, seasoned CSS pros once in a while are like, ugh, how do I, what's the, you know, I don't have any problem getting the spacing I want, but getting the spacing I want within a really clean system without, you know, being feeling like I'm writing some one-off CSS that might muddy this system. It's just tricky for everybody, I think.
Yeah, I mean, so like for me, the classic example is you do like a headline and a paragraph, right? And then, so you're like, okay, I'll put a margin bottom on the paragraph or the headline.
Right,
so
to move them apart from each other.
To give them some breathing room. Well, the next comp that comes on your desk, there's a little subtitle byline under that heading.
Yep.
And so now you have to remove the margin there and then put the margin top on the paragraph. But now, like, now you just... I don't know. Like now you have now you're playing a margin top game, which is just
kind of because it's tempting to be like, yeah, you can't differentiate backwards. You can't say if this H1 is followed by div class subtitle, then don't put the margin on it. That's like a reverso selector that you can't really do. You could do it with JavaScript, but that's like not a good use of JavaScript.
I would kickstart a reverso selector in CSS. Who do we need to get? Do we get tab on this?
Right. So that's too hard. So yeah, it is tempting to then use top margin instead of bottom, right? In some cases, the web always feels like a push downy kind of medium to me. And I admit that I tend to lean on bottom margin instead, but then it does regularly come up, you know, that I'm writing like P last child margin bottom zero in my module like things, which seems a little fragile because it's like, oh shoot, this one ended in a UL now. So maybe I should make it star selector last child and remove the margin. But then like, is that a good idea? You
know, I have a client's framework. They're like their pattern library style guide thing. It's all built with margin top and it drives me nuts. It's great. It's fine. But it drives me nuts because, you know, it's the same problem. It's like, what if you put like a, you know, yeah, like a H3 in there and, you know, under the thing. And so now you have like H3s have the margin on the top and like, and you can't like make things tight. And like, it's all, it's like, you're like override city, like trying to get things either way. How do you kind of approach spacing, Chris? Let's get to the question.
That's such a big question. That's like, I don't know. I've been liking definitely using relative units like everywhere for this kind of thing, but that's, you know, that doesn't actually help you do it. That's just a unit selection.
See kind that of thing. I was going to say, do that. Like a sass variable is very helpful. Like start with like 1.5 m as your like base padding. And then cause I think this is maybe I'm going to make a lot of designers mad here, but I think a lot about padding and vertical rhythm is consistency over like just making sure it's consistent. Like if you have like 6 pixels here and 27 pixels here, it's like, that's not helpful to a lot of people and developers. And it's just like just making up padding for each thing. So like having like a consistent baseline that you kind of multiply, I think is smart.
Yep. I have often made a, you know, $ padding variable in my SAS and tried to use it a lot. And then sometimes did, you know, padding times two, if I'm on a really big screen or whatever, and just want to push things away. I don't know. I don't not like that. I know that was a double negative, but
I don't not like that.
No, but I found like I almost never change padding. So like, why did I do this? But it's not really about changing it later. It's about being consistent while you're using it, I guess. So that's probably not a bad way to go.
So I think if you work on like a modular basis, you know, like the header and the nav, you can kind of like hard code that like that padding, like kind of specify what that is, the footer too. But then you kind of have these modules where I think you want to kind of specify the padding within the module, like your article module or your sidebar or widget module. You want to kind of like nail down what that padding is, kind of build out some rules for that component. However, like when you smash two components together, like what happens when you put two articles together, like how much padding do you need there? It gets a little confusing. And I think you kind of have to, I don't know, you kind of have to, it just, it depends on the design in the project, but I think you have, that's when it starts getting tricky for me, is like when you start smashing modules together, like the heading module and the paragraph module or whatever article module example I said, like, oh, if that heading module can have anything in it, it's going to, you know, that causes problems, you know. And the second you get it right, somebody drops an image in there. It's never.
So we're talking about kind of nuanced things. And there's just, I don't know if there's a really like all encompassing way to talk about how do you handle spacing? Well, I handle spacing this way. You know, the closest thing I've seen to that is maybe you should look up Hayden Pickering's owl selector thing, or lobotomized owl, which is star plus star margin top, which is kind of clever. It's like, if this thing follows, if this element is preceded by any other element, then space them out. But if it's not, don't, which I kind of like, you know. I can't say I've ever used it in production, but it definitely falls into the extremely clever market. I threw a Twitter poll out there just now, Dave, with absolutely no context, asking people to vote for either margin bottom or margin top. And margin bottom so far has the lead, 59%.
Well, so, there you go. Science, I believe, agrees with us that margin top is LOL. I'm voting margin bottom.
Awesome. Bottom.
But I think also, what I kind of like are these, there's kind of like, I don't know, some style guides. I'm looking at one for, I guess I just Googled, but I think this is Volusian's style guide, but it's like margin top zero. So like that zeros it out. Margin top XS and margin top S, margin top M, margin top L, margin top XL. And those kind of go in not a modular scale, but they go in a rhythm of size. So that could be like a way to do it too, is like a class in your HTML that you say, okay,
charge
this
of
one.
The spacing.
Yeah.
I guess that doesn't terribly offend me.
Dude, I was like this style guide with margin top or whatever, it led me down a path where I was just like, I don't hate div class margin. I don't like just an empty div, like just a spacer div. I like,
really?
I was just like, man. I don't hate it from a component perspective. Like, Web Standard said,
I was taking a nap and I heard something truly offensive.
Oh, I'm sorry, Colonel WB Standards. I was just joking. Christmas joking.
Oh, thank God. I'm going to return to my slumber.
Oh, goodness gracious. I don't want to wake you. I don't have the time or energy for that. All right. Goodbye, WB Standards, Colonel. Oh, wow. Oh, God. I got spooked, Chris. I did not expect him to show up right there.
Okay, good luck, Mathieu. Let's move on. Nilesh.
Nilesh writes in, is a CSS reset or normalize important, or should I write my own CSS-based rules? I'm curious what your CSS reset file consists of. Do you include CSS reset on top of your base rules? That was kind of two.
Probably load it first. Yeah, so if you're going to use a reset at all, or normalize or sanitize or whatever, which are little, you know, repos for that serve a similar function of reset. It's like, give me some styles to work with that deal with the cross-browser stuff, which there's plenty of. I guess normalize's ideals were, there are plenty of weird things cross-browser still, and let's document them, and then let's make a style sheet that deals with them. And then the idea being, you should alter this too, because if you apply CSS, what you're doing is normalizing across browsers for the most part, you know. So that was normalize. Sanitize is a similar kind of variation of that. And a reset was just like a little bit different, and like, let's not normalize these styles, but blast them out. Like, start with as little as possible. I've been seeing some writing about this recently. You know, one of them was like, is the time for resets over? Like, there's not as many differences as there used to be across browsers, so maybe we can maybe just stop using them entirely and just leave some browser defaults in place. I'm a big fan of, you know, I feel like the Chris Coyer reset from our, maybe we should declare this a law. I don't know. You'd have to be on board first. But mostly I use Star Selector, box sizing, border box for one thing. I consider that a reset because I love that one. And I used to use a lot of margin zero, padding zero. And I feel like on the, you know, on the universal selector. And I feel like that's starting to go away a little bit. I can't decide whether I like blasting margin and padding out on absolutely everything or not anymore. But whatever, it either has that or it doesn't. That's about all I do. I have read another article that said, hey, maybe we should blast out the kind of the star selector all reset or whatever, that all property in CSS that really blasts everything down. You know, and then the opposite of that, and I've tried to build a website before fairly successfully where you just use no reset at all. And then you don't even add that many things to, you know, like, for example, an H1 tag has some margin and stuff already applied to it through the user agent style. It's not that bad. Just leave it alone.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, when I'm just riffing on a code pen or something, I'll, you know, check neither, you know, because you have CSS reset, normalize, or neither. Right. I'll just sometimes, just to get her done, check neither. I'll do star box sizing, border box. And then I'll do HTML and comma body, margin zero, padding zero, just because I never know which one does which. But I'm looking at normalize right now. And it's just the body needs margin zero. Just to kind of like take out that kind of ghost padding that's on the side there. And then I don't know if it's still necessary, but I still do like height 100% there too, like just to like make sure it takes up the full window. But I'm not sure that's necessary so much anymore either. Or I'm trying to think when I would like what I'm trying to do there, but I do that. Let me just skip over to somebody who knows how this works. Nicholas is normalized CSS. If you go through it, like it's available, it's online. Like go read the source code. I think I got this from Paul Irish, who did a whole talk on like what I learned from reading the jQuery source code, you know, like read through this. It's fully commented on what everything does, you know? So, it sets up like a universal line height and sans serif and WebKit text size adjust none or 100%, because that'll keep whatever like iPhone and Windows phone from like trying to resize the text to whatever it wants. Article section, something display block to make IE9 work. There's like some H1 sizing, which is interesting. Fig caption, main display block, some styles for figure, so HR pre. You don't need all these. What I like to do is I like to take normalize, dump it into my SAS, and then start breaking it up into chunks I'm going to use. Like I want like a background color transparent or something. I want, I want some of these smart defaults.
So you're a normalized guy, you'd say.
I mean, the form stuff too is so helpful. You forget that you're gonna like set font. You have to set the font family on your button and put op group select and text area. So
the way that you would do that, though, I think the smart way to do that is to take this copy and normalize, and where it sets the font family. Actually, I don't know if it does that for forms. I suspect it does though. Yeah. So you don't just use normalize and then in your own style sheet override that with the font that you actually intend to use. Alter your copy of normalize to set the font right there, right in normalize.
Yeah, that's like the point. Normalize can be your like starting point, and it can be like, and you can like cannibalize it into your system. I think it's a good way to go. And then kind of document what changes you're doing from normalize. But there's so many good things in here. I mean, they have the template element. Did you think about that last time you made a site? No.
No, there's a bunch of weird audio stuff. There's a bunch of weird like sup and sub stuff. And
attribute hidden, display none. Adoy, that's a good piece of code. That's helpful. Look at this. Solved problems. But you know, if you run this, if you put this on your site and you run it through like that CSS audit, the un-CSS, it'll be like, you're using 5,000 unused rules. Because that thing is just a complainer. But anyway, this is...
It's worth looking up sanitize.css too. It's similar to normalize.
Yeah, I would just go read through the source and find which one matches your coding style. I'm going to look at sanitize. Live Googling here.
I think it's, I don't know.
Oh, that's Jonathan Neal. Jonathan Neal's a trustworthy individual.
Yeah, especially at stuff like this. I think this is the kind of thing that his brain excels at, although it excels at plenty of things, I'm sure. I don't mean to box you in, Jonathan, but yeah, it has the border box stuff in there, which is one of the reasons that I really like it. I think it's, I don't know. I hate to overgeneralize, but I think it's slightly more opinionated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Version of this.
Yeah, no, and it's very similar, but yeah, it looks like a fork of it, and it's great.
Yeah, it is, because he was involved with the original Normalize too, so.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's one of those things where I'm like, on CodePen, I'm like, we should have a box for sanitize too, because I would use it more, because I'll use a reset or normalize, but then I have to add the box sizing stuff, because I like demand that every piece of CSS that I write has that on it. It would be so nice to use sanitize, but it's not like we're dragging our feet. We have just other things we're working on at CodePen, but you know how we in the JavaScript land, we used to have, like, way back in the day on CodePen, it used to be like you just select jQuery from a dropdown and then you have jQuery available to that. We got rid of that in favor of, like, now there's a quick add thing for JavaScript. You select jQuery, all it does is just put that up into your list of URLs that you're using. I would love to do that for CSS as well. We have quick add for CSS, but it still has that kind of legacy, like, which one of these resets do you want to use? And I could add sanitize to that, but I'd rather just get rid of it entirely and just have it be like, I want to use this kind of piecemeal, whatever. I know that's a little, probably some inside baseball stuff that people don't care about, but like, that's the reason sanitize isn't in the choice of three there. I wish it was, but I didn't put it there just because I know we're going to get rid of that area altogether. Okay. So resets, that was fun. I like how we haven't really, we just have been, we'll just say resets, talk about it for a while. That's what's going to happen here next too. I guarantee it.
Let's talk about this one for 10 minutes. Come to no conclusions. Let's go.
Yep. Mart Oosterveld. My question is about jQuery. Okay, here we go, Dave. I personally work on some projects where Angular, Angular 2 is being used, and Angular and jQuery aren't supposed to be used together. Do you see jQuery making way for jQuery frameworks, or is this just a specific situation which jQuery should not be used? Here's the deal, Mart, as far as I understand it, there's a lot of libraries that just have their own kind of concept of managing the DOM and being helpful for you in that regard. Angular being one of them, certainly React and Ember, and there's many, many Vue, and I saw some other one yesterday that was Ember-like. You know, there's easily 100 of them, and they know what's going on in your DOM, and they change the DOM for you in a lot of situations, right? And so, like, jQuery was like, I'm going to give you some tools so that you can mess with the DOM. So, you know, you go in there and go, like, div class equals modal dot remove or whatever. Okay, cool. Now it's gone. You just wrote some code that found that element and removed it from the DOM. The reason that doesn't work with Angular is because now, if you were to write those two things together, Angular has no idea that you just removed this modal from the DOM. And it'd be like, it's bound to cause problems.
Yeah.
If it's like, going to remove something from the DOM, it should do it so it knows what's going on.
Yeah, I was going to say, like jQuery is a DOM manipulation library. Like its job is to go in and, you know, show hide,
remove. Right, and Angular manipulates the DOM too, though, right?
Angular does too, but Angular is almost like it's like a DOM management system, like almost like a content management system. It's like it manages all your elements, all your events, and it's kind of keeping that in like, I don't know, keeping that all together. You can like shoehorn the two together and use them, but every time I see that, every time I see like jQuery in a React project, I get the straight up heebie-jeebies. I'm just, or not even like, oh, they did wrong. It's like, wow, that's a lot of code just to pop something off. Or what are you using jQuery for? That's like my big question is because like document query selector all is maybe just as fast and just as well supported. So it really just, I don't know. It like,
there's no way it's going to end well. It can't.
Yeah. I just get a huge code smell whenever I see those two together. And I'm just like, what? Like, why is it there? That's my thing. That's like,
yeah, I would suspect that if you just happen to notice both of those libraries being loaded, that there's a decent chance that people aren't loading React to not use it, but I would suspect some people are loading jQuery only to not use it. I bet there's a decent chance that jQuery just is doing nothing. It's just was just in a template somewhere as being loaded up.
Yeah. Yeah, or some third-party library includes it, or some advertisement includes both React and jQuery.
Yeah, there you go. Copy. So is jQuery moving? How did Mark put it? Do you see jQuery stepping aside or something for these libraries? Yeah, absolutely. And nobody's. Yeah. I think the maturity has arrived with these. It's not versus. jQuery is amazing. It's still amazing. It's still probably used by a zillion more websites than any of these fancier new libraries are. And it's going to be used for a long time. It's still very useful for lots of websites out there. It's fine. It's just that, yeah, they're not supposed to be used together. And if you find yourself in a very like big, complex, app-like, state-heavy website, it's definitely gone out of fashion for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would just, if I was starting out, I'd just use, you know, vanilla JavaScript, document query selector all, until it didn't work or wasn't helpful. Like, you know, like closest is like my favorite example. Like when you ever, you're like, oh, I want $.closest, and that's going to be like 10 lines of JavaScript, you know, like, and it's just not, it just doesn't feel good. Or you find yourself using like multiple things that jQuery has or trying to backport those, then you should probably just use jQuery or some custom build of jQuery. But then if you're, like you said, if your app has a bunch of state and a bunch of like interaction, like I think it's probably smart to leverage something like Angular or React, probably more on the React Preact side of things. So
Let's stick on jQuery for a minute. I moved some stuff around here for you.
Yeah.
Because Paul Wolke wrote in as feedback to an episode a couple of episodes ago where, Dave, you offhandedly mentioned that I think you were removed jQuery from your site or in the process of doing that.
I did.
You did. Okay. And then something weird happened. I can't remember what the offhand remark is. Let me just read the question, though. Jave mentioned that taking jQuery off a site actually made his site load slower, which is weird. Similar experience here. Removed a call to jQuery, replaced it with a small function, less than 10 lines of code, and did not see the anticipated performance boost. It turned out that it actually degraded performance. I'm sure there's lots of variables, like what's the new function like? How is it coded, you know, that replaced jQuery? What other factors on the page could have been an influence? But I found it quite ironic to hear a similar experience of worse performance without jQuery.
Yeah, no, it's weird. I removed jQuery and my performance got worse, and I don't know what is causing it. Here's my thought: is I put them in
performance in what sense? Real quick, like was because certainly you removed like hundreds of bytes of code that couldn't get worse, couldn't get slower, like load time wise.
I removed. Gzipped and everything. I mean, we're talking 40 something kilobytes of code and replaced with, you know, gzipped probably 1 kilobyte of code. I mean, I removed everything, rewrote everything in just vanilla JavaScript. But where I think what's causing the slowdown is the script is loaded async, but I think what's happening is I put the code in a closure, like a self-executing function kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that starts blocking the thread. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I wonder if when you throw it in a closure, does now your JavaScript say like, oh shoot, he's doing something, everybody stop, like what, you know, like
I don't think I've ever heard that, but I can't speak to it. I don't really,
yeah,
it doesn't seem like just a self-executing function would do any thread stuff. Well, but like what metric the only thing is I worse can think for you, is, Dave?
What's the only thing the I think is I think it's just the self-executing is causing the rest of the JavaScript to not kind of parse and execute. So I don't know. That's the only thing I know. That's the only thing I can think of. Hey, can you hear my dog? I might have to go yell at my dog. Is my dog barking?
Yes.
Okay, let me go yell at my dog. 1 second.
Well, it's just me now. Just me, and I wonder if I could... I've been listening to that podcast, The Message, where, like, there's this alien signal that makes weird sounds and it like can affect people's health and stuff. Or if there's anything I could say to like change Dave's apartment while he's gone. If you layer like three of those on top of each other, I think I pretty much nailed it.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by a really cool conference that you should know about. It's called A Day of Rest Boston. Rest, like, what do you just take naps at this? No, of course, it's a programmatic version of REST, meaning like a REST API. And specifically at this conference, the WordPress REST API, which is a big new thing in WordPress land. In WordPress 4.4, the foundation for it dropped. In WordPress 4.7, coming out this December, all the endpoints for this API are going to be on all WordPress.org sites. It's a big deal in WordPress, a really nice API coming to WordPress near you. Do you not know enough about it? I know most people probably don't. This is the only WordPress REST API conference. It's coming up March 9th, and it's really a three-day event. It's March 8th, 9th, and 10th, and the 8th and the 10th, the days around the 9th, which is when all the speakers is, there's workshops. So it's like, let's say you want to build a site that's like a React site and you want like a bunch of JSON to be the state to manage this React site. How cool would that be? Hint, extremely cool. And the WordPress REST API can power that. Do you need to learn a little React? Get on board with all this? Well, then take Wes Boss's workshop, which is March 10th. You need to level up your JavaScript in general. Get used to this. Figure out what you can do with all this JSON madness coming your way. Take the Intro to JavaScript workshop. That's March 8th with Zach Gordon. So cool. It's put on by the folks at HumanMade and the some of the people behind the WordPress API itself. The co-lead of the WordPress REST API, Rachel Baker, is speaking. She's the director of engineering at Wirecutter. Phil Sturgeon's going to be there, the author of APIs You Won't Hate. So apparently he doesn't hate this one. And in fact, I've worked with it a little. It's really nice. It's really cool. Some of the best conferences I've ever been to in my life have a really tight focus around one thing. Everybody's there is cares about this one thing. They got their laptops open. They're hacking around this one thing. The questions are about it. All the information is focused on this one thing. And how specific is it? The WordPress REST API, a whole conference out of it. It's called A Day of Rest Boston. It's coming up March 9th. Check it out.
Still poll results coming in here from my contextless margin top versus margin bottom poll. 400 people voting so far. Still 59% margin bottom. It's funny how a poll can, it went up and down a little bit, but it literally hasn't changed since about under 100 voters. Some replies include Tab Atkins, we've had on the show, saying this poll is wrong. Margins are always pushing boxes around, so it's totally a top, which I believe is sexual innuendo. I don't even know if it's innuendo, really, at that point. Brad Westfall says, lobotomized owl advocate, so margin top. David DeSandro pipes in to say that margins are designed to be collapsible. Didn't know that for years. Floats mess it up. Yes, indeed. Like, if you have margin bottom 40 pixel, margin top 40 pixel, the space in between those two things will be 80? Nope. They collapse down to 40. If one of them was 50, one was 40, you'd take the bigger of the two. There's some other caveats too. Pretty weird. Keith Grant also says, lobotomize owl for the top, otherwise not using then margin bottom. Joe Califa writes in, just don't use them together and you won't have to deal with the weird collapsing margin thing. Collapsing margins don't bother me too much. Yep. So we're just wrapping up that question about jQuery making a site slower, or removing it making it slower, which is super weird and contrary to most discussions about that. It seems to me this is the kind of thing that could be sorted out. Like, there's something very weird going on there, and like scientifically, if you remove 39 kilobytes of JavaScript from your page, that like the at least what's coming down the wire is smaller, and there's no way that that can be slower. It just can't be. So there's something tricky and weird going on there, and it seems like something that could be sorted out. So make a reduced test case for that would be absolutely fascinating. So we'll look forward to that. And then, do you have any final words before I move on to this next JavaScript related questions.
So I will say that. So I removed web fonts and jQuery, and it's possible I'm doing something kind of malperformant. Like when I don't know. I kind of moved some things around. I think I was doing the best thing, but like I removed web fonts and it got slower, like slower on page speed. Both the article and the homepage, slower on page speed desktop. The speed index though on my article page is like 200 points better, and that's good, but it's 100 points slower on my homepage. I can include a link here. It's an article I wrote called Spring Cleaning on my blog. But it's really weird. It was very unexpected, but I think, you know, it's that thing with like performance metrics. Like sometimes they'll lie to you. Like sometimes they aren't like,
you know, I heard an interesting question posed. I can't remember where I read it. I just read it yesterday and I should have looked into it more. Maybe it's a recent article that said, why is there, I think it was on Reddit, why is there variation in internet speeds at all? You know, like, why is it that if you run a test over and over, or why is it that my speed of my internet connection fluctuates over, you know, throughout the day or whatever? You run two tests, no two will be the same. Not even for web performance, but internet, anything at all. What the heck is it? Why does it vary? What are the factors that go into it? And I think the answer is there's just like a billion. It's just a zillion billion things. You know, there's power fluctuations, and there could be a storm somewhere in Oklahoma that's affecting something somehow. And, you know, there's all these routers involved and electricity involved and just natural forces that it's just like, I don't think all possible, you know, factors of what makes something the speed that it is on the internet can be tracked down. So maybe some of that is at play.
Yeah. I mean, you would need like a laboratory, like isolate, like your own internet, but then like you'd have none of the real world problems, but you'd need like a laboratory micro internet that, you know, to test all of your stuff on, and, you know, few thousand miles of cable inside your little laboratory to make it like all seem correct. But
it seems like very interesting research to take on. I'm sure there's some people that know a lot about that. That would be a really cool article to read. I mean, and actually it might exist. That's why people are talking about it. But
yeah, it was very unexpected, you know, but it could also been my third party just decided to be bad that day. Like a bad sized ad, or, you know, slow third party JavaScript, or by making.
So, I mean, but just to be clear about this, because I don't think I got a great answer on that. What is the metric that was slower afterwards? What were you measuring?
I measured three things. The page speed insights score for mobile and desktop, okay, before and after on a homepage and an article page. And I've been using the same one for all my like perf test posts. And then a 3G, the 3G fast speed index of my page. So my article page is
so both these things are like, they take into account stuff that we are not even sure what they take into account, right? Because both these are metrics that are just like a score. That's an algorithm of lots of stuff combined.
Right, right. Page speed is like what it thinks your like website, you know, how fast it thinks, you know, it perceives that it loads, you know, and then speed index is like the perceived performance algorithm, how much of your page renders before something else, you know. And it's, you know, it's possible I made something faster and so something appears slower. Does that, like, that's a little, maybe not a truth statement, but like, you know, like if it's all about perceived performance, if now my page renders very, very fast, like first paint on with no web fonts and no jQuery, and then it takes a while.
I see. So like logo, you see now renders the slower. Frame of the site faster, thus there's more like white space time in between when like some content shows up or something. That's interesting to think about. Yeah, like you should have just showed nothing until it's already. Yeah, perceived performance is a big deal.
Well, and it's good, and it's good for users, and you should try to do it. But it's also a little bit of smoke and mirrors. You know, it's a little bit like I don't know, just you're trying to pull one over on the user. So. All right.
So this is another JavaScript question I think is interesting and perhaps some people have wondered about from Mike Wags. I'm curious to hear both of your experience with event modules, things like PubSub, Emitter, or whatever you want to call them. The concept seems really nice to me, but I'm not sure when is the right time to implement them. Is it overkill for smaller projects and only really suitable for highly interactive application? Or should I get it in the habit of using them all the time? What are the advantages and disadvantages, if any, have you used?
What are you trying to, like, so maybe we should define what PubSub or event emitted modules are. Like, in my mind, it's kind of like a WebSockety kind of thing. You have, like, browser A will do something like edit a title. That'll push an event to the server. Hey, title edited. The server will push that event that, like, it'll say, hey, all browsers, a title was edited, like, right. Refresh your title. And the JavaScript on the other clients will update the title, right? Does that
That's
sound
a
right?
good way to put it. I think that's smart. Even though you don't, there doesn't necessarily actually have to be WebSockets going on for PubSub, like, conceptually.
Mm-hmm. It could be a server pushy kind of thing.
It could just be a client side only thing. I mean, let's say somebody, okay, this is where I'll go with this, and it'll hopefully explain why your analogy was kind of perfect for it. Let's say you're writing some JavaScript, some really simple JavaScript for just your blog or something, and you have a button that says contact me in the footer or something, and you click it and it opens up a modal, right? Well, you had to write some JavaScript to do that. So you wrote a click handler of some kind that attached itself to that contact me button. And then when they click it, it does some stuff, change some classes, and opens up that modal. Well, you've attached now some doing of some stuff to that click handler. So that's fine. I guess that works. Okay, cool. But what you could have done is said, when that click event happens, what I want you to do is publish an event happened. I want you to publish the fact that this modal is opening. And then elsewhere, like maybe in some other file, I don't know, depending on how you organize your code, you can have a listener that subscribes to the event of a modal opening. Mm-hmm. And in there is where you would actually like change the classes and do the work of opening the code. So it's kind of a way of structuring your code such that you're not going to do stuff right at the click handler. The click handler is just going to like publish that this event happened, and then somewhere else you're going to write the code that actually does. It's kind of an organizational system. But why would you complicate it and split that up in this really simple contact form thing? I don't know. You might not. It might not have that good of – that might not be that useful in this one-page app situation. But if you're in a WebSockets kind of situation, let's say, you know, you're trying to keep two worlds in sync or whatever, two browsers, like a title has changed kind of thing, as Dave described, there literally is no click event that happened on that second browser. You can't attach anything to the click event. There was no click, but there was an event that happened. You are still trying to open that modal. So it's much easier to have kind of invented your own little kind of event system,
yeah,
that can react to that. You've subscribed to this event that has happened, and then it can change.
Yeah, so. like I think a good place to snap this and break it up is if you find you're doing a lot of things like, oh, you click this button, change the text in the header and change the text in the footer, like in two different places.
You've done two things now, yeah.
Like, I think what's better is you have the whatever button JS say, okay, trigger this button clicked or whatever, special button event, trigger special button event. And then your header JS says, okay, on header button event, special button event, do this. And then your footer JS says,
right, because that's the point, is you have now you've been able to split up your code into header JS and footer JS. So you don't have headery things and footery things happening in the same file.
Yeah.
They're two different files that have two different concerns, but they can both subscribe to the fact that this thing has been clicked or changed or whatever.
Yeah, so now that you've like separated these concerns, you kind of like, you're more modular, I guess it would be the right term. You can now drop this thing in on any page, this special button event emitter, the button that emits the event, and you can have any component on the page can just listen for that and do things with that. This is also like handy if you do like analytics and tracking and stuff like that. Like, you know, somebody's like, oh, when they click this button, I want you to like email my office. You know, I want you to whatever, post this thing in my Marketo. And this, you know, that would be a good place to be like, you know, on special event, click, you know, do something with Marketo or whatever. I think that's like
It feels like almost more work up front, but it's like a lot of things, it's actually less work later. If you're like, oh, this is just how we do events on this app, you can feel free, like, okay, well, it's the separation of concerns starts feeling really good. Like, okay, let's see, there's a DOM event happened, so I'm going to publish that this is these are the events that are, you know, that I want to happen. And anywhere else in your app, you can subscribe to that event happening. And react to it. And it's not just like one other place can listen to it. You know, you might have 10 places throughout your code that's listening for that event to happen and doing the thing that that piece of code is responsible for. Like, oh, this one's going to actually change I'm going to subscribe to it in some kind of DOM.js that's actually going to visually change on the screen what's going to happen. There might be something else that just handles like syncing data back and forth between the server. That one's also listening for it. Be like, ooh, something changed. I better persist that data back to the database. It makes sense that you're not doing database work in the same place that you're doing DOM work, you know?
Yeah.
But they both can subscribe to the same thing.
And I don't think it's for everything. I think it's like, I think Mike kind of said it. I think it's kind of for highly interactive things. I mean, you know, your blog probably doesn't need this and but maybe your shopping cart does, you know, like I clicked the add to cart button. Now I want the cart and the header to increment the number. And I want a little modal to pop up that says you added to cart. And I want a little, you know, whatever. I want the product to blink and swirl around, you know, like those, that would be a place you'd probably want to use this sort of system. And Chris, can I mouth blog a little bit here? I realize it's a shared.
Is it about Docker?
It's a shared platform. Well, I could mouth blog a few curse words about Docker right now. But I've been thinking about like, you know, the whole web app versus website thing, you know, and I almost find the, like, I don't know, lack of distinction confusing. But you have a great post on this on CSS Tricks and a poll that you did, but I've just been thinking about like if something like requires interaction in real, like what's the real life thing? Is it an interactive thing in IRL? Like, you know, reading something? No, not very interactive with other people. It's just you in some text, you know? So that probably, like, if you're reading a tech, like a blog, you probably don't need to interact. If it's, you know, I don't know, writing some like Word document or something, that doesn't always need to be highly interactive, but maybe you work in an office that is kind of collaborative. So maybe it can be highly interactive. You know, is it chat? Yeah, that's really interactive. So that should probably be more JS. Like I'm just trying to like rather than like a binary web app or web or not web app sort of thing, I'm like a interactivity scale, like a slider, the more interactive.
I could almost envision a UI for this that has like, there's a left half and a right half of a screen, yeah. Right? And on the left half is all this stuff, chat, or like all the things that you mentioned, all the things. Like, is there a lot of buttons on your app? Is there text areas? Is there real time? And you drag them to the right-hand side of the screen. Oh, my app has this. It has this. It has this. And I said the word app, which I wasn't trying to do, but my website has this, 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 this. And at the bottom, it's like, yes, I see. That's a React site.
Yeah. once you start piling things on, like interactivity, like in kind of using human interaction as the base of that, I feel like that's like maybe a good metric or rubric. I'm going to use that word, a good rubric for whether or not like you should have a React app or something. So anyway, that was a mouth blog, Chris. That was coming to me this morning. That's like shower time to this time. It all worked together.
Yeah, right. So. Like clearly it's a spectrum like everything else in this planet.
Yeah.
And, but it's true. Like it's not particularly useful to say something is an app and something is not an app. Like it feels, but at the same time, people are really kind of hold on to that idea. And in the poll, you know, like, I don't know if it is a great post, but it is referenced a lot. This like, why do we try to separate these things into these two buckets. The poll results were, we should separate these things into two buckets. So don't forget that. My point was that
it's great. You know,
and like Jeremy Keith talks about it a lot. Yeah, is that there? It's not particularly useful to do that. Why do we keep doing it? But the data shows that people want to do it.
Yeah.
So maybe the more useful thing is to say, if you really want to do this, start thinking about it as a spectrum instead of two buckets.
Ah, there we go. Look at us being pragmatic here on the Shop Talk Show. Hey, expect this kind of level of pragmatism to coast into 2017. Jeffrey Kern writes in, hey guys, longtime listener of the show. The only thing I love more than this show is pizza. Hey, I was on the papamurphys.com/menu anchor and pound sign, and I was looking through their site. I have never seen markup like this. I was wondering what your thoughts are. Div, I'm going to mouth code here. Div, angle bracket, header, angle bracket, section, angle bracket, footer, star 30. Hmm.
There's lots of footers. I was poking around in there too. I don't see 30 footers next to each other, but I do see, a main section. Okay. The main has a nav in it. The main has a whole bunch of sections. Main, section, 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 section. Within that section, there's more sections. In that section, there's div class container, div class collection, div class item. You know, there's some sites just, I'm not crapping out anything here. Sometimes you need a bunch of wrappers. You just do sometimes, you know. Within each one of these items, then there's a header, section, footer. Mm. Header, section, footer. Header, section, footer. Header, section, footer. Not next to each other, but each within div class item. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It does seem a little unusual because I guess I thought headers and footers should be within sections and then it's okay, but I actually don't know the answer to that. I don't think anything here is too grievous.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, oh, this is this, what's that Emmett IO? Yeah, is this Emmett? But,
he was just describing through Emmett what the DOM looked like.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I think you can go overboard. I think this is maybe part of these new semantic elements' problem that, you know, what does header mean and what does section mean and what does footer mean and does it, if my website is pizza, do those have headers, sections, and footers? I don't know.
Each one of them, I mean, let me mouth blog describe one of these div class items to you. Well, it's describing different pizzas. So it's a cowboy pizza. So there's a big bold, it says big bold cowboy at the top. Then it says what's on the pizza? Red sauce, pepperoni, Italian sausage, whatever. You'd think that would be a list, but it's actually just a comma separated thing, which I think is fine in this case. And then below that, it's a button that says select a store, presumably to order it, right? So it feels like to me, it would just be like, I don't know, H2, because it's, you know, it's within a section that there is an H1 on the page. And then a P for what's on the pizza, and then an A for the button to go do your thing. So I'd probably write H2, P, A. But in this case, the H2 is wrapped in a header, the P is wrapped in a section, and the A is wrapped in a footer. It just seems a little heavy on the HTML5 wrappers.
Yeah, I would probably get rid of those wrappers. Why not? Less code, more maintainable, you know, but they probably have this item in a template that they're looping through. So, you know, it works, but, and maybe there's another place on the site where that header is way different, you know, and we just don't see it on this page. So that item component is actually very, very complex.
In fact, if there's a subheader here, that actually might be useful into the thing we talked about earlier and being able to adjust the margins and stuff more specifically because there is a wrapping element.
I think it's probably okay. So I would.
Jeffrey Kern also writes in, why do developers make the best spouses? They know how to commit. Loyalty.
Hey, that's a loyalty. He says, P.S. Dave, you should open up with your quote unquote great jokes again. I think we should probably spend some time and write up some new material. I'm sure it's been about 4 years, so I can probably come up with some new jokes, new React jokes. I'll have to kind of get my reactive joking going. I can probably do this. So lots has changed.
I'll react with a laugh. Tom Evans writes in.
Hold on. I want to do it again. Yeah. Or should I say, I want to redux it again.
Ooh, redundant.
Duck.
It reminds me that we once had a soundboard on this.
I know. I was somewhere somebody was like, hey, where's the soundboard? And I was like, I don't know. I forgot. I misplaced it, and it's actually my son's like little iPad now. But I now that I'm on the supercomputer, Chris, I have a new computer. I'm probably talking faster because this computer is faster. And I have a new computer, and now I have the Surface here.
I have so many feels for you, Dave. I like think that's so fun. I think that's how it's one of the ways in which that we as adults experience fun again. Cause like, seriously, like it's not that I don't enjoy my life, but I don't experience fun in the same way that I did as a kid. I'm well aware of that, but opening computer components and piecing them together to build a supercomputer definitely qualifies.
Oh yeah. It was fun. It was also traumatizing, but it's been fun. I'm working on a post. I can do another mouth blog. It's our podcast, but, you know, I don't know. The analogy I keep coming back to is actually like frameworks, like CSS frameworks. If you think of a framework as kind of like smart defaults and things like that, you know, a Mac or a Dell, you know, these are kind of smart defaults that all work together and they balance some kind of, you know, battery power, you know, some sort of equation. They're balancing, things. But when you build your own PC, this is like a custom thing for me. I selected parts that I wanted, that I think I need, or that suit me. And so it's custom tailored to my needs. It has just a killer graphics card because I wanted to occasionally play like high-end games like Overwatch or Doom or something like that. It has a water cooler just because I thought that would be fun and I didn't want to look at a big dumb fan. It has 32 gigs of RAM just because I kind of wanted more RAM.
Yeah, 32 is a good number.
My case has a weird VR port on the front of it just because I was like, I might do VR one day. So, so yeah, it's, I don't know, man. This was fun. And it was a good experience. I am like the consequence of building your own custom thing though, means you're responsible for all the problems. And I've had problems, with this PC, Chris. I forgot to plug things in right. And, so it would just crash every time I was playing a game. I like messed up like screwing on the CPU. It's fine, but it was not the best. And then like, I'm still having problems. I tried to install Docker yesterday and, it just murdered my whole computer. It was like Hyper-V on Windows and Docker were just not getting along. And it was awful. It ruined my day. And I'm like,
well, you're recording this show on it right now.
Recording on it. And, you might've heard my dog barking earlier in the show. Well, a little peek behind the scenes here. I went out to go yell at my dog and my computer crashed when I came back. I also locked the door on myself on the way out. So I don't know why, but I locked the door, Chris. And I had to use keys to get back in. And I found a blue screen computer when I got in. So there's still a bug.
Well, the startup time must be pretty quick then, because it's only like 2 minutes.
Oh yeah, it's super fast. That's what's good about these machines is they're fast. But I was just like, ah, man, like I still have a blue screen of death happening. I don't know. I thought I got rid of them all. And that's my issue, my problem that I have to kind of work through. And I mean, I don't know. It's kind of like you know, if you built your own car or something, that's maybe not that extreme, but like. I built this custom thing, but now all the problems are my problems. I have to figure it out. I can't take it to a genius and say, hey, my computer keeps.
That's blue true. There's literally nobody you could ask, really. I don't even know if the Geek Squad would touch this thing.
No, I don't think they would. I mean, they might, but I need to like basically remove each component one at a time and plug it back in. And that's how I find out what, you know, what's broken and what works and what fixed, you know? So that's not the best.
I forgot about that.
It's not the best thing in the world, but you know, hey, I'm enjoying it. Well, I like this machine. So.
Well, there's probably a MacBook, you know, gathering dust on it. That's just going to whisper to you, Dave,
use me. I think my Mac has actually ran out of batteries, but I'm going to benchmark. So I'm going to put together a post. I'm going to benchmark my Surface, my Mac, and this new PC. Not because I'm like worried this is slower, but that would be a twist, but who knows. But I was going to benchmark just to, cause I want to like know how skewed my perception is. Like my quad core MacBook is very good. My dual core Surface Pro is good, but not the greatest. Like I hit the limitations of that hardware from time to time. And then this computer is just hella fast. I mean, I've already ran some like graphics benchmarks on it and it's just great, but I kind of want to just see how skewed my perception is using this giant piece of hardware now. So I'm going to include all that in a post and probably some of these mouth blog thoughts here. I've already kind of started working on it. So anyway, that's my setup, Chris. I really like it. It's fun. Computers.
Nice. Yeah. I just am staying in Macland because I prefer to at the moment. Although, you know, there's just been a lot of people switching in my life. Alex Vasquez at CodePen, my co-founder, is switching to Linux, also with a custom built box. Ooh. Like you got. And Miranda went Google Pixel.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty wild. I ordered a new MacBook Pro, so it's not a big change, but it will be a new computer, which is the first time it's happened in like 3 years for me. So that'll be good. And I'm looking at all kinds of stuff. I just learned that you can, I have a Toyota Tacoma. Which the radio in it is fine, but it's like the most boring car radio ever. It has no features, no Bluetooth, no nothing. And I was like, oh, they have these new car stereos. Now, they're probably not new at all. I just was oblivious to the fact that you could replace your car stereo with not just one of those like single slab little like, you know, fancy controls, CD player or whatever, but you can get a full on like panel display thing that's got Bluetooth, but it's also got Android Auto and CarPlay and navigation built in and all that stuff. I'm like, oh, dude, I totally want to do that. And I was like, I'm not having fun researching it and stuff. I'm like, I think this is what I consider fun these days, is just like technological, like,
whatever tech upgrades here and there. I bought this is turning into a really fun weird show. I was at the end of my notebooks, like my note-taking notebooks for like client calls and stuff, and I got new ones and I couldn't be happier. I got brand new like Moleskine notebooks. I'm so happy. I also picked up a notebook. I'm going to do that bullet journaling that Rachel Smith was talking about. So she just posted over on
that was a good blog post.
Rach Smith. I don't know Rachel's blog. But anyway, she posted on bullet journaling. Elise Holiday, who's also been on the show, is doing it as well. Had pretty good success. But it's just this kind of whatever GTD strategy, get things done, where you like whatever, make an itemized list of your month, things to do this month.
Funny doing it on paper. Day. I wonder if that's more like, I used to be heavy on like post-it notes, but I've lost it. Yeah, but you know, you can see in the posters, it is rachsmith.com. She chucks stuff off and whatever. It looks a little bit almost like the six things to me too. I don't know if you've ever seen that one, but it's like I've been rocking six things. I woke up this morning and made my six things. Record Shop Talk is number five on that list. I'm doing them out of order, but it's on there. I like six things. I do it all through notes on OS X, but it could be anything. In fact, sometimes I use Markdown files.
So you just,
God, I gotta close this Papa Murphy's tab. Pizza looks good. I'm like 4 days into doing a new Whole 30 in it. That pizza.
Oh yeah, that's got a lot of gluten on it, Chris. You're not gonna like it. It's not good for you. And cheese. This is I don't know. That's interesting. So every day you wake up and you write six things you gotta do that day. Is that
most days? I wish I was better at it. I need a better app. I want like a menu bar app or something, or like something that's not what I'm using now, which is just another thing in notes. I need something that puts it right in my face.
You kind of wish like you had like personal assistants, you know, like you logged into your computer in Siri or Cortana. And I bet I could actually make Cortana do this, or Slackbot was like, hey, Chris, good morning. What are you like? Give me like, give me the six things you're working on today. And then it pushes it to your menu bar app or something. That would be cool, huh? Like just something that like interviews you real quick. Like that would be nice, but I don't know.
I didn't even know the Windows thing was called Cortana.
Yeah.
I do now, though. It's funny how just a concept comes along and then everybody just does the same thing.
Yeah, bots, bots, bots. I got to be careful saying the C word, Cortana, because...
Oh,
because
your computer...
She'll start... Like,
what would you like me to do? I have temporarily paused everything else waiting for your command.
Okay, shut down. Great. Ah, Cortana.
This week's episode is brought to you by Typekit Marketplace. Typekit Marketplace is a new way of selling fonts with prices set by the participating foundries. What kind of foundries? Lots of really good foundries. Type Network, Frere Jones, Type Together. All these foundries are participating. And what's nice is they've offered a simplified, kind of a unified desktop and web licensing. You don't have to dance around like, oh, can I use this font on 1.2 computers, or you know, or does I have to get the web one and I have to go like re-encode it and all that? Typekit solves all that for you. It's a unified license for your desktop and web. You don't need a Creative Cloud plan, but it just like you buy it and it like can start syncing to your computer through Typekit. Desktop, web, it works. Check it out at typekit.com/marketplace. That's typekit.com/marketplace. It looks really good, and I think you should check it out, especially if you do any kind of designing and want to get those high quality fonts in your website.
I want to do one more because I mentioned him by name, and then we'll right, call it off. Okay. Tom Evans writes in, there's been an opening for front end department head of the department that I'm in. This is something I'm very interested in pursuing. And I've applied for it before, and I was younger, not as wise, less mature. I also went in previously with the knowledge that it was unlikely that I would get the promotion. Sounds like you didn't get the promotion. Now the story has changed. I'm a little older, a little wiser. I've been told that I'm a good candidate for the position. You know, wink, wink, one to watch. The thing is, I'm still a young buck at the ripe age of 25. Ripe is such a weird word when combined with age. Ugh. For reasons I would appreciate your advice and tips and what to do, what not to do. I can't tell you exactly what to do, what not to do, Tom, because, you know, every workplace is different. And there's so much like emotion and politics and stuff involved with this that I can't possibly know. I can give you some generic tips that I would think maybe are useful to you. One of them is, and I love this and I didn't come up with it, and it's like all the time I think back, we actually republished it on Chop Talk Show. It was part of this panel on a list apart put together where we talked about front end design, and this one of these things came up of like, what does it take to be a senior? It's kind of the position you're applying for. A department head is kind of like a senior front end developer, if not even higher than that, right? And one of the things was that, clearly you got to be good at your job. Clearly you have to bend around a little bit, you know, have a little seniority around the place. Clearly you have some like quote unquote leadership abilities and some communication abilities. I don't mean to push by those because those are incredibly vital. In fact, I would promote somebody to head who was good at leadership and communicating more than I would somebody who just happened to be good at CSS or whatever. But the general word that I really, really, really like that came up during that previous panel that I mentioned is the word force multiplier. Are you, Tom, a force multiplier? When somebody like comes to you for advice, can you combine your two powers and do more? Do the people who come to you and work with you and that you will have control over, are they better at their job because you're around? Can you turn one into two? Can you turn 8 into 16? You know, like, is that what you do there in an abstract sense? And if that's the answer, then yes, you should be the head of that position. Can you demonstrate that you do that somehow?
Yeah, I think that's good. I think I like what you said about a good communicator. I think you have to be really good at email. Like that's like a core skill, and you have to be good at navigating your company. If you're, you know, it doesn't matter how old you are. It kind of, that matters how long you've been there. You know, seniority is kind of relative to like knowing how the business works. You know, you can, if you know how to navigate the business, if you know, like, oh, whatever, Joe from accounting gets really mad if we're like 2 days behind, so we got to keep it on schedule. Like, that's very important. I was talking to Brian J. Brennan. Brian loves swords on Twitter. He works at Boku, and he had switched from developer to Scrum Master. So now he's a project manager. And I kind of like interviewed him on Twitter, like DMs. I just was like, tell me about this. Cause I'm very curious, like what prompted you. And his whole thing was, and I hope it's okay that I'm sharing this, but he was like, I love it when my friends succeed. Like that's something I really like. And that's what I'm here to try and help do. I'm trying to grease the project, you know when I need to jump in or when I need to step out. But like, I'm trying to just help my friends succeed at kind of getting things just out there and shipped and done and make people happy, make clients happy, make my coworkers happy. That's what I take joy in. And I thought that's a wise attitude as well for like this kind of department head. Is that something you enjoy, helping your team succeed and be good at the job? It'll also mean you might have to fire people if you're like the head of some department. So you got to be comfortable with that sort of stuff. But anyway, hopefully that helps you, Tom.
Yeah, definitely apply for it.
Yeah, always try to move up that ladder, I think.
I think maybe the fact that you applied for it last time gives you a little plus one, you know? It means dude wants
it. Well, and
you
know? not to like, don't whatever put your company on blast, but like, if it doesn't happen this time, have a talk with your head or your boss's boss or whatever, and just say, let's put me on a path to be this. Like, I've done this twice and like, I'm only going to do it a third time. So like, let's get me on a path to do this because this is something I'm interested in. And I don't want to just be the dev for the rest of my life. I like, kind of put it on them, like, hey, I need to move up in my career. So like, let's figure out how I do that. So that's their job as an employer as well, I think. I mean, right, Chris? I don't know. You employ more people than I do.
I love that. But
I think just put the onus on them. How do I move up? What, like, you tell me like how I get qualified for this next time around. So.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the structure is like at this place. Maybe you're not even senior yet, and you're trying to jump past senior to this, and maybe instead of getting this, you go for senior.
Yeah, like have an honest look too. Like, is there somebody in your department that is actually way better for this? You know, I mean, not that shouldn't discourage you from applying, but like, what do they have that you don't is maybe a question. So.
Love it. Good place to end it. Positivity. Everybody be positive.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening to this episode of Shop Talk Show. Thank you for downloading it in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to star, heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. If you hate your t-shirt, head over to shoptalkshow.com/shop, I think it is, and get a brand new one for this holiday season. You'll look good on Christmas. You know, take a picture under the tree or the menorah and just show.
Yeah.
How happy you
are. Oh, we had a question we didn't even get to that was about that had a book recommendation in it that I was going to recommend. While you're buying that book, you should go to A Book Apart and buy my book too for yourself for somebody else or whatever. It's called Practical SVG. And boy, I would just love it if I sold a few more copies of it. I'll tell you
what. Give the gift of SVG this holiday season. It's like the K jeweler butt heart jewelry. All right. This has been another episode of Shop Talk Show. Thank you very much. Follow us on Twitter @Shop Talk Show. Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
No, just Shop Talk Show.